Okay, so we'll get started, and then those who aren't at the meeting will trickle in. The first two classes of the semester, we've devoted to discussing the origins of the Beis Knesset, the origins of the shul, and its rise in the context of the needs of Jewish people and Jewish communities in different locales and different places. We identified its origins, at least as far as we can reconstruct based on the physical evidence, in Egypt. That was where we located the shul. Then last week we explored how the practices that instantiate in these shuls seems to have been variable. In other words, we shouldn't always expect that there would be uniformity across all of the shuls that we're going to find. The Jewish community was extremely diverse, and importance of creating some sort of systematization or broader halachic system that the Jewish people can abide by is actually one of the projects of Chazal. What I'd like to do now, sort of using that as a springboard, is transition, I think, to a different topic, which is slowly building up to something that I've been kind of putting off now. I've been promising you that we would discuss it, but I've been putting it off now for a year and a half. We're finally going to build up to it. And that is, at what point in our story do Chazal become a force? So up until now, we've been, I think, deconstructing some of our expectations as we approach this period in Jewish history, the end of the Second Temple period in the next couple of centuries and the rise of Christianity. We've been deconstructing some of our assumptions about what Jewish leadership would have looked like on the one hand, and the consequent uniformity of Jewish communal practice on the other hand that we would expect if the rabbis were in charge from already the Anshei Knesset HaGdola and then all the way through. Some of the things that we've seen is that there's actually a great deal of variety, and that in fact accounts for some of the trends that we see that end up becoming disturbing trends, like the rise of Christianity and so on and so forth. But what I'd like to turn our attention to now is the question of, well, fine, at what point, we know at some point the rabbis become a very significant force in Jewish life, and in many respects shape, in almost every respect, shape our Jewish community as we know it. So at what point can we begin to talk of rabbis as a force? We've discussed Pharisees, for those of you who recall. We've discussed Pharisees on at least two occasions. We've gone in depth. We've done an in-depth treatment of what we know about the Prushim, about the Pharisees. But we made the point at the time that Pharisees are, or at least should be, analytically kept distinct from rabbis, even if we can talk about, as I think we can, continuity between the two. But the question that I'd like to ask is, at what point do rabbis become a thing, if you will? So part of what we're going to have to do in order to answer this question is lay out what the landscape of Jewish law would have looked like in a relatively early period when we begin to hear about Chazal. So let's say the first two centuries of the Common Era. So basically the very end of the Second Temple period, just before and then just after the Rakochva revolt. What sort of landscape of Jewish law can we imagine? What did practice look like? What were Jews doing at this period? The way I'd like to answer this question is actually, well, so in other words, we could approach this one of two ways. We could either approach this, if we wanted to figure out what Jews were doing during this period, so how might we approach this? We had to kind of put on our historian's hat. What kind of evidence would we look for? What would we use?
Textual evidence.
So what kind of texts do we have? So the most obvious recourse, the Mishnah. The most obvious recourse would be the Mishnah, redacted together in about the early 3rd century of the Common Era. The Mishnah might tell us what Jewish people are doing at the time. The problem with using the Mishnah is that it can become circular. In other words, if we want to figure out what people were doing in the time of the Mishnah, so using the Mishnah is going to tell us what the Mishnah expects people to do, but it's not going to tell us, at least potentially, what they're actually doing, although maybe it does. Yeah.
I probably want to look at Roman historians, because they're writing and sort of cross-reference it with what we can find in the Jewish story.
Right, so perhaps another tack we could use, which we've used in the past, is to say, well, let's look at what people are writing about Jews. In other words, someone who's a dispassionate observer, at least to a certain extent, we can account for their biases. So for instance, when Pliny describes the Jews, he describes, at least at some length, the Essenes. So when we examine the Essenes, that was very helpful to us. The problem is that this period, the descriptions of Jews are less helpful than we would have expected. And in particular, even people who are describing Jews are describing interesting Jews, anomalous Jews. They're not describing you and I. They're not describing the hoi polloi of common Judaism, as we've complex common Judaism, as we've been calling it until now. We are actually quite fortunate to, really almost by accident, in the 1960s, a famous archaeologist in Israel by the name of Yigal Yadin. Yigal Yadin was an ardent Zionist, and a renowned historian. His father, Lazar Sukenik, was a famous archaeologist, and Yigal Yadin followed in his footsteps. He was a famous archaeologist. One of his most important discoveries was the cache of letters that he termed, and that we now know as the Bar Kokhba letters, which included actual correspondences between Bar Kokhba and his Bar Kosiba, and his captains and his troops, people who were in his army communicating with each other, and so on and so forth. Incredibly important. Among the other things that Yigal Yadin discovered were a series of documents that actually belonged to individuals who were not part of his army, who just happened to live in the area near the Dead Sea, the caves in which these letters were preserved. People during the Bar Kokhba revolt apparently fled into these caves where they hid. Unfortunately, they seem to have died there. These documents were left behind. So we happen to have, among other things, the archive of several people. The archive, the personal sort of filing cabinets of several people who preserve the Jewish people are now and always have been very litigious people. So the Jewish people, Mimekedem, were filing lawsuits, were disputing over Yerusha, were trying to figure out who gets the apartment in Rehavia. So here too, the people were you know, going to court, and they kept their legal documents, and we actually happened to have come into possession of them by an incredible stroke of fortune. What I'd like to do this evening is take the personal documents. We're going to do a little snooping. Take the personal documents of a woman named Babata. Babata is a woman who lived in the southern tip of the Dead Sea in a town called Ma'oza, and she, quite fortunately for us, left her filing cabinet. We actually have what was in there. What I'd like to do is contrast two very similar documents, but in many respects worlds apart, that have been found in her archive. One is her ksuba, her wedding document, which she used to get married to her second husband. And then what I'd like to do is contrast that we're going to read that ksuba, and we're going to go through some of its important clauses and figure out what it means for us. Then we're going to take that ksuba and we're going to contrast it with the ksuba that her stepdaughter, Shlomtzion, was to contract with her husband only a few years later. So what we're going to do is read those two ksubos, or at least read relevant portions of them, and we're going to try and look very closely at what they say and don't say, and then tease out what those implications are for the history of this period and for us as modern Orthodox Jews living on the Upper West Side today. So take a look at source number one. Actually, you know what? Before we take a look at source number one, I usually don't do this. Usually, the picture on top is just to entertain you while I talk at you. But this time, I've actually given you something interesting. The picture. Does anyone know what? Well, I've described it on the bottom, so I've given the game away. But the picture on top is a picture of a get. What in Chazal is called a get mekusha. What is the opposite of it? Well, in other words, there are two types of gittin, not as in a divorce document, but a get can just literally mean any document. There are two types of documents that Chazal described. There is a get mekushar, and what's the opposite of that? Get pashut. What is a get pashut? A get pashut is basically when you have a piece of paper, in this case usually a papyrus, and on this papyrus you write out whatever document you're contracting, you have witnesses sign it, and then you're done. You roll it up and tie it up, and then you're done. A get mekushar is a tied get. Archaeologists and historians also refer to it as a double deed. And what it is where you have a papyrus. On the top, you write a copy of what your contract, let's say it's a lease for property, you write out a copy of the lease. Then, right below it, you write out another copy of the lease. Then, you fold up the top part, and you tie it. So if you look at this picture, you can see up top here, these little lines, these are strings. So you kind of make holes in the paper, and you loop the strings through, and you tie up that top portion, and then the witnesses sign right next to the strings, right next to the ties, and that is meant to authenticate the document. That way, You can make sure that nobody can tamper with the contents. It's signed, sealed, delivered. And then the bottom half is for reference. In other words, the bottom portion is the part that if you need to look it up for whatever purpose, you can read it. But if a court ever needs to authenticate the contents of the lease, they break open these strings and unroll it and take a look at what it says. That's what a double document is. So now, Babata's documents very often have been preserved in this fashion. The ksuba that we're about to look at was preserved that way as well. There are two copies of it. The top half of it is lost to us. This is the bottom half. This is what it says. They're not identical, but usually the bottom half is written more carefully than the top half. So we're lucky to have the more accurate. So now, the ksuba that Babata contracts, we're not going to read the whole thing. We're going to read some important portions. The ksuba is written, as you can see, in Aramaic. Now, you might ask me, what was the hava mean? In other words, what other language would you think the ksuba would be written in? Anyone who's ever been to a Jewish wedding knows that the ksuba is written and read in Aramaic. What else would you have expected? We're going to see in just a moment that there actually were other options. The Mishnah already talks about other options, but insofar as, at least before I came upon the discovery of this, I'd never seen them. This was eye-opening for me. But Babata's ksuba is written in Aramaic. If we were to read it out loud, it wouldn't sound like the ksuba that we use. In many respects, it would sound somewhat different. For example, instead of having the phrase, the very important phrase, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael, it has Kedin Moshe V'Yehudai, which is very similar according to the law of Moses and the Jewish people. So it's very similar. There are other differences. The dating is different. Some of the formulas are different. But here are two clauses that I think are very important that we should examine. Take a look in source number one in the top. This is the document that's called Pi Yadin 10, which stands for Papyrus Yadin, Papyrus discovered by Yadin, number 10. We know for a variety of reasons that this was written sometime before 125 of the Common Era, but the part of the document that had the date on it was ripped away. Unfortunately, we don't have it, so we can't figure out what exactly the date was. But some of the other papyri, we can actually tell you exactly what day they were written on. I just think it's pretty cool. So, Pi Yadin says as follows. Uksuseich. Sorry. We're going to start from 1, 2, 3, 4... five words in. Okay. Vim tishtabai afarkinich min besi min nechasai va'asivnich le'intu uksubasech ki yama alai. One of the clauses in the ksuba is as follows. If you, says the husband, the husband's name is Yehuda, the son of Elazar Ketusion, that's his name, so Yehuda. So Yehuda says to his wife, if you're taken captive, I will redeem you from my house and from my estate. And I'll take you back as my wife, and I owe you the money of your ksuba. That's one of the clauses. Now take a look at the... Now before we read the next clause in the ksuba, so take a look at this source right here, Mishnah Ksubos 4:8, right? Mishnah from Perek Dalet. The Mishnah tells us, now the Mishnah lists five clauses that every ksuba must have. Now, as a note, when I say ksuba, when the Mishnah says ksuba, what is a ksuba? So we call it a marriage document. We call the document that we have a marriage document because that's how it always instantiates.
It's a divorce document, essentially.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, it also stipulates what happens when you divorce. That's true. But I think the assumption that we're all making, and part of it is because it's actually in the word itself, is that a ksuba refers to the actual document. The document that you have, that's called the ksuba. The way that Chazal use it in the Mishnah, with one exception, is that the ksuba doesn't actually refer to the document, it refers to the obligations contained in the document. This is going to be important, very important, as we'll see, especially in the next ksuba that we examine. But, in any event, the Mishnah lays out five clauses that every single ksuba obligation must have, and if it doesn't, the courts impose that obligation. So in other words, you can't have a ksuba. You can never, if you were following Chazal, we'd never write a ksuba without all of these stipulations. The stipulations are, for example, you have to contribute a certain amount, minimum amount of money to your wife. So, for example, if she's never been married before, it's 200 zuzim, 200 dinar. If she has been married before, then it's going to be 100 zuzim, and so on and so forth. One of the clauses, which is, and they're all listed in the fourth parak of the Mishnayos Ksubos, is as follows. Lo kasavla im tishtabai afarkinech va'osvinech li leintu chayev shu'utanai basin. If a person didn't write in his ksuba the following words, if you're captured, I will redeem you and I'll take you back as my wife, he's nonetheless obligated in this responsibility because it's a stipulation of the courts. In other words, this is one of the absolute binding clauses. You have to have it in your ksuba. If a rabbi performed your ceremony, this is what was in the ksuba. And lo and behold, we see in Babita's ksuba that this is exactly what she wrote. Now, tell me what might strike you. What might strike you about this? The Mishnah says that it has to say, "Intishtabai afarkinech v'osvinech lila intu." Now, is that what the ksuba says? So what does it say? In other words, it doesn't contradict that, but what might we know? There's some extra words there, right? Now, we know from medieval sources and more especially from modern sources that you're not allowed to change the language of the ksuba. Matbea ha-ksuba, the phraseology of the ksuba is sacrosanct. This is, as you can see, as we'll see from this document and as we could see from any ksuba from this period, this is a substantially later development. The idea that every single word of the ksuba has to be identical in every single other ksuba is a much later development. Any ksuba that you'll look at from this period is going to vary. All the documents are going to be different. We don't have a single example of a ksuba that's identical to another ksuba from this period. It's worth noting that when Chazal here are saying that the ksuba has to contain this phraseology, what it likely means is that it has to contain the gist of this obligation. In other words, this obligation, as Chazal stipulated, must be in the obligation, must be understood by the husband to be part of his obligation, and how he expresses it is broadly, at least within limits, is up to him. Now take a look at the next. Take a look at the next bit I've given you from Bavata's Ksuba. It says, "V'im ana ahach leves alma kadamach or kadamech." To have a yasva or mitzinan min beisi min nechasai adzman di yitzvun. That should probably be there. Should probably be a yod there. Yartai lemintan lach kasaf ksubaseich. So the clause says as follows: if I go to my eternal home before you, you'll dwell in my house and be provided for my estate until the time that my heirs wish to give you your ksuba money. Now, there are two points that have been made here. Now, before we think about what happened at before we think about what happens at weddings that we've been to, so let's keep that in a pocket for a second because I'm going to ask you that in a second. But what are the two clauses that are here? There are two things that the husband has. That there are two things that the ksuba states.
That if I die before you, you'll be staying in the house.
One.
And until my heirs give you back your ketubah.
They can kick you out, as it were. As long as they pay you,
they can... They have to pay you, but they have to pay you the sum, I assume, that's stipulated in the ketubah.
Exactly, right. They can pay you off. In other words, you have the right, after I die, to be supported by my estate until such time as the heirs exercise their right to pay you off. Those are the two clauses. Now...
Someone assumes that it's the same marriage on this one. Because
in what sense?
Because it would almost be that... My heirs, our children.
Our children. Ah, very good, very good. And you're correct about that. In fact, this is Babita's second marriage. This is a marriage to her second husband. Yes, good point. Good point.
You said that every ketubah had to say the same thing. So, if this is his second marriage, is this one of the five stipulated things in the Mishnah that it has?
So, excellent. Excellent question, Ms. Deegan. So let's take a look at that. Take a look at the source to the right of the Mishnah we just read. This is one of the later Mishnayos in Ksuvos, also in the fourth parak. Now, before we read that Mishnah, let me ask you a question. I know it's nowadays when you're at a wedding and someone's reading the Ksuba, more often than not, the smartphones are out. But for those who either don't have smartphones or who are enthralled by the romance that is the Ksuba, that is the what happens if we divorce and I have to pay you X, Y, and Z. What do our ksubos say? If the and I also the it's Aramaic, but the if for those of you who've been to a wedding and recall what our ksuba writes, right?
Certain amount of money.
Right.
Is it all about money?
Right. So you get money.
But only
Right. True. Right. Also. So in other words, once you in other words, if you divorce, your ksuba is paid out, and if the husband dies. And if the husband dies, you have the right to be supported, to be given your ksuba, to be supported. But the way that, at least, we paskin la halacha, or at least how we paskin with respect to what we're about to read, so this is actually not what we write in our ksubos, that the heirs have the right to pay you off. This is not what we write in our ksubos. Now take a look at the Mishnah that we've just seen here. You can actually see... what's going on here? Why this ksuba is written with this clause? That the heirs have the right to pay you off. So the Mishnah says, "Atehe yaspa bevesi umitzina min chasai kol yimei megad amanuseich bevesi. You shall dwell in my house and be provided for from my estate for the duration of your widowhood." That's the standard language in the ksuba. You, if I die, you get to be supported by my estate. Kachayu anshe Yerushalayim kosvin, anshe Galil hayu kosvin kanshe Yerushalayim. That was the sort of ksuba that you would find in the area of Jerusalem, and the people of the Galilee would write a similar ksuba. However, Anshe Yehuda, Hayu Kosvin, Anshe Yirtzu Hayarshim, Litein Lech Ksubaseich. The people of Judea, outside of Jerusalem, that's exactly where this was the southern tip of the Dead Sea, in Judea. If you lived in Judea, you didn't live in Jerusalem or in the Galil, then you have a clause that says, if the heirs want to pay you off, they have the right to do so. As the Gemara ends up saying, the people of Judea cared much more about their money than their kavod. So this is, yes.
Sort of a question. Could you elect your heir?
Not in this. Not according to this. Yes. So what we have here is, in fact, now if we stopped here, if the shir ended here, what sort of conclusion would we draw about how Jewish law works in this period? And you know, I'm actually going to leave the question a little open-ended. I want to hear what are our thoughts? What does Jewish law look like during this period? Why is it the way it is? What is it?
Local,
right? So in other words, there are people who are doing things in Yerushalayim. There are people doing things in the Galil. People doing things in Yehuda. Fine. Now, who is in charge?
Men.
True. Any men, that's true, right? That seems to be the case. Any men in particular? Right. So in other words, so Dr. Schwartzbaum suggests maybe Rabbi Akiva, a rabbi. Now, why would we assume that? Why would we assume? I think at this point this year would be a fair assumption. Why would we assume it would be a rabbi or rabbis?
You mean in charge of what?
Well, in other words, why are Jews writing? Why is Babata writing a ksuba? In other words, where does Babata get the language from her ksuba? At this point, from the Mishnah? It sounds like she gets it from the Mishnah, right? Now, if that's the case, and keeping in mind the notion that there are in fact regional practices, we might assume that these regional practices are either governed by or in some way regulated by the Mishnah, by the rabbis who would eventually come to constitute the Mishnah. That's what we would assume based on the evidence that we had at this point, because why would we assume otherwise? We have a source for Jewish law that's recorded in the Mishnah. We have actual evidence of what people did on the ground, and it sounds like it came right out of the Mishnah. Okay. But take a look at the source just below that. From Piyadin, I've written Piyadin Verso. Right? So if for those of you for whom it's your first time handling papyrus, I actually have a little piece of papyrus. Should have brought it in. It's much more brittle than you would expect. Basically, when we're dealing with papyrology, so the front side, at least in these documents, the front side is called the recto, the back side is called the verso. Now, what that means is as when the scroll was, in this case, when the scroll was rolled up, what was written on the back of the scroll? So the answer is, in this case, what was written on the back of the scroll was that this ksuba belonged to Babata. Okay, so the ksuba was given to Babata. Now, on the other side, on our side, there were signatures. The signatures of people who apparently were, for whom this document was important. Now, let's take a look at who signed on this document and see if we can figure out who everybody is. So take a look under the part that says signatures, starting on what's number here, line 20. Some of this has had to be restored, but the parts that are important to us didn't need to be restored. Okay, Yehuda bar Elazar al Nafsha Ksava. Yehuda, the son of Elazar, that's the groom. We know from the Ksuba that he was the groom. al nafsha ksava, he wrote this by himself, right? Which either means that he literally personally wrote this. That it happens to be that we know what his handwriting looks like, and this is his handwriting. So he wrote this himself. Well, sometimes that could mean someone wrote this for him, but he commissioned it. Okay, so he wrote this. Yehuda signs on the groom signs on the ksuba, and he writes his own signature. The next line, we don't know what it says. The line after that, Babata Baras Shimon Al Nafsha. The wife signs for herself. Now, we happen to know from elsewhere that Babata is illiterate. So take a look at the next line. The next line is somebody, maybe Eliyahu is that word, Bar somebody. So in other words, Ploni, Ben, Ploni, the son of Almoni. Now, what is that last word? Mamara. Right there, if this were Hebrew written the way we're used to it, there would be an aleph between those first two mems. Ma'amara. This was done by her ma'amar, by her command. She authorized that someone should write her signature, right? So the groom signs by himself. The wife signs, but she's illiterate, so someone writes her name for her. And then, take a look at line 24 there. Toma Bar Shimon Sahad. What is a Sahad? A witness, right? Like the Gemara, when the Gemara says Anan Sahade, we witness. So Sahad. And then somebody Bar Yochanan Sahad. And then a third witness is written. So there are three witnesses. The groom signs, the bride signs. And that seems to be different from today. And then probably the scribe signed also. Now, why is that? Now, Ms. Deegan says it's different from today. In what way is it different from today? Wife doesn't sign. Husband doesn't sign. Only have two aided. Now, So now, Mr. Dre is saying that there are cases where the husband does sign, and in fact we have evidence from the Cairo Geniza and from elsewhere, ancient ksubas that we've discovered, where either the groom will sign, or there'll be other sorts of contracts where the people who are involved, not just the witnesses, the person involved in transacting, signs as well. The only thing for which we have absolutely no evidence and no precedent anywhere in rabbinic literature or in practice is the wife signing. This seems to be anomalous. How do we explain this? It happens to be that the wife signing, both the bride and the groom signing, would have been something that was quite common and in some cases required in Ptolemaic practice. So when the Ptolemies, not too long ago, were ruling the region, this was the standard way that things were done in the legal system. Even when the Romans came in, the old legal system stayed in place. The Romans didn't really do much to change things. So the fact that the wife is signing here seems to actually be something that was not required or motivated by Jewish practice or Semitic practice or anything else. Seems to be something that was required because that was just how Gentile courts or Gentiles in general authorize their documents. So, now things begin to be a little more complicated, and we're going to complicate things tenfold when we look at the next source. But now things are a little bit more complicated. Why? Because what we see here is, on the one hand, Exuba, where parts of it seem like they have been excerpted from the Mishnah, which would imply uniformity, a powerful Mishnaic influence on society. And then at the bottom, we seem to have something that Chazal do not account for and do not discuss and seems to be eliminated from Jewish practice down the centuries, and yet is somehow present here, presumably because that was what Gentiles did. On Aksuba. So how do we account for this? Turn the page over and take a look at this. Source number two is from a ksuba that was commissioned for Yehuda's daughter. Now remember, Yehuda is the man that Babata just married. The ksuba that he gave his wife Babata was a ksuba that was written in Aramaic. The clauses were reflected in the Mishnah. He promises to redeem her, he promises to keep her on, the heirs can pay her off. The whole thing sounds like it was a ksuba straight out of the Mishnah. For his daughter's wedding, the ksuba was written in Greek. First of all, now, Chazal talk about documents being written in Greek, being enforceable and based in. Okay. The first thing that I thought when I looked at this was that it's jarring. It is jarring. We're so used to ksuba written in Aramaic, ksuba being, every ksuba being identical, so that it was written in Greek is jarring. Now, before we do anything else, let's take a look at what the ksuba actually says. Now, one of the things that's reflected in the ksuba, as we've discussed, is the terms of what happens when there's a divorce or when there's a death. But what is the first thing? This is the part when everyone's still paying attention to ksuba. What does the ksuba say? The ksuba says that the bride and the groom have been married. How? Or under whose auspices? Kedas Moshe v'Yisrael. That's the standard ksuba. And that language, more or less, is in Babatas ksuba as well, and several other ksubas that we found. Take a look at how... Now, what is marriage Kedas Moshe v'Yisrael? It's nice to say it, but what does it mean? How does marriage work according to the laws of Moses and the Jewish people? How do you perform a marriage?
Witnesses.
Now you have to give kesef, right? In other words, you have to give a ring or whatever the case may be. So this is all premised on a verse in the Torah. Which verse in the Torah? Ki yikach, as we'll see in a moment. Ki yikach ish isha, right? When a man takes a wife, that's how marriage occurs. In other words, the husband has to give something to the wife. It's a transaction between the two of them. And that's how marriage is accomplished. Okay, take a look at this ksuba. Now, this is a translation of the Greek. We're going to read a couple of words in Greek just so we get a sense of really the weight of how different this is than something that we would expect. But for now, let's take a look at the English. After the beginning of it, which I've cut off here, is just the date. So we know that this is from April 5th, 128 CE. So the anniversary is coming up. Judah, son of Elazar, also known as Ketuzion, has given over Shlomtzion, his very own daughter, a virgin. The word there is parthenos, so it doesn't need to be a virgin. It could just mean young woman. That's an important point of controversy, actually, between Jews and Christians. The word that Yeshayahu, in the Septuagint, uses, in the Greek translation, uses to translate Alma, the word Alma, which just means young woman, doesn't mean virgin, is parthenos. Parthenos can mean virgin, it can also just mean young woman. That it's been translated virgin here is of no consequence to that, but it's worth noting. So, Judah has given over Shlomtzion, his very own daughter, a virgin, to Judah, surnamed Kimber, son of Hananiah, son of Somalas, both of the village of En-Gedi, in Judea, residing here, for Shlomtzion to be a wedded wife to Judah Kimber, for the partnership of marriage according to the laws, she bringing to him an account of bridal gift, in other words, as a dowry, feminine adornment in silver and gold and clothing, appraised by mutual agreement, as they both say, to be worth 200 denarii, 200 dinar, or 200 zuz, of silver, which appraised the value the bridegroom Judah called Kimber acknowledged that he has received from her by hand forthwith from Judah her father. So in other words, he says, I got the dowry. And he owes to the said Shlomtzion, his wife, together, in other words, that sum, together with another 300 denarii, which he promised to give her in addition to the sum of her aforestated bridal gift, all accounted toward her dowry, hakol shari v'kayim, and so on and so forth. Now, before we analyze things, we have to break down exactly what the clauses are here, and then we have to ask ourselves the question, why is this not just important, but astonishing? What are the clauses here? What has happened in this ksuba? So what's the first thing that happens?
The father gives away the daughter.
Now, for anyone who's been to a Jewish wedding, is that what we would have expected? Mm-hmm. No. What does the pasuk say, as we said? Ki yikach ish isha. In other words, the man, the husband, takes a wife. That's the only valid way for kiddushin to take place between adults, right? So, at the very outset, this seems to violate all of our expectations about how a Jewish marriage should take place.
How old is this girl?
Excellent question. Let's hold on to that for a second. The short answer is we don't know, but that's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. We're going to get into that very issue in a second. Good question.
No, I mean, she's 12 and her father has the right to give her away or not.
Excellent. Now, hold on to that for just a second. Now, I should point out that this is that in several of the Greek suvas that we've recovered from this period, this is the formula in which marriage is transacted. The woman is given away. But let's hold on to that for a second. Now, so the father gives the daughter away, and then what happens? Then what happens after that? So he gives her away. The bride and the groom are named. Their marriage is according to the laws. Which laws? We're not sure. It doesn't say. And then what happens? It's a dowry. Now, first of all, what does the dowry consist of? In other words, it's a gift card. It's not a gift card to Macy's. What is it?
Jewelry.
It's stuff, right? In the language of rabbinic Judaism, how would we classify this? So it's not kesef izav. In other words, what would we call it? It's not karka, right? It's not land and it's not money. What's the other option? Metaltalin, right? It's goods. Okay. So he gives her stuff. How much stuff does she give?
200.
Right. So it wasn't enough to just name what she gave her. What she gave, they had to appraise it. And the amount that she gives is 200 dinar. Okay. Then what happens?
Well, it sounds like what she's giving is for her use. It doesn't sound like what she's giving is for babies.
Right, that's true. In other words, she's bringing in stuff, the feminine adornment, right? In other words, she's bringing in stuff for her. But it's going to be...
And her jewelry and her stuff.
Right. Ah, so that being the case, so what happens next?
He
has to bring stuff in too. Now, how much does he bring in? This is important. 300 dinar. Okay. If anyone's learned Mishnayos Ksubos, this should already start ringing alarm bells. But let's hold on to that for a second. And then that's basically it. Then it's all accounted toward the dowry. Okay, so the first thing that we have to deal with, because we can't escape it, is that this is not a kiddushin Kedas Moshe Yisrael. At least it doesn't seem like it. This isn't the marriage that took place according to the laws of Moses and the Jewish people. Why not? The laws of Moses and the Jewish people require that the husband take his wife, and that is how things should be expressed. That's how things should be expressed in the Ksuva. Havalele intu Kedas Moshe Yisrael. She is for me a wife according to the laws of Moses and the Jewish people. The Ksuva here is not phrased that way. Now, what is actually going on here is as follows. The word that is used here for has given over, in other words, the father has given over his daughter in Greek, is exedata, which is a form of the verb ekdidome, that's a Greek verb. What that means is to give over. In Greek law, a marriage that has been contracted by using a form of the verb ekdidome is called an ekdosis marriage. An ekdosis marriage is how Greeks, for hundreds of years before this, in Egypt and elsewhere, were getting married. All marriages took place by being authorized with an ekdosis clause. Ekdosis clause means you have E-K-D-O-S-I-S, ekdosis. An ekdosis clause is basically as follows. What it requires is the father has to give away the daughter to the husband. In other words, there needs to be a transfer of the daughter to the husband. Why? Of the authority over the daughter from the father to the husband. Why? The assumption is that somebody has control over this woman forever, and she doesn't have agency of her own, so that control has to be transferred over to somebody else. Not so in our kiddushin. In our kiddushin, the transaction has to be consensual. You can't be mekadesh a woman. You can't betroth a woman shelo midaita without her consent. So in this case, for an anekdosis clause, the father gives the daughter, or the mother or the brother gives the daughter over to her husband, and immediately in that context, the dowry is discussed. Those two things must be connected. That's how an anekdosis clause traditionally works. Here we see exactly an anekdosis clause. Some form of the verb ekdidome in Greek is used, and immediately afterwards the dowry is discussed. Great, ekdosis marriage. Take a look at the source over here. It's under P Oxy 2372. Oxy stands for P as usual stands for papyrus. Oxy stands for the city of Oxyrhynchus, which is a major source of papyrus from around about this period, where lots of wonderful discoveries have been made. I've given you a picture of one piece of the papyrus. What the papyrus actually says, for those who are reading some Greek, exedata anophris. Anophris is the name of a person, an Egyptian sounding name, gave over his daughter in marriage. So this an exedata, a father giving over his daughter in marriage, standard practice. This is from 74 CE. This marriage was from 100. Our marriage is from 128 CE. This is how people are getting married. That's how things are going. Take a look at the source below that. This is one of the earliest references that we have to Anecdotes' marriage from 310 BCE, 400 years earlier in Elephantine in Egypt. Heraclides takes Demetria. Now here, takes the word, the verb used there in Greek is lambane, which means he took. The good way to remember that is lambano, which is what it comes from. Sounds like something that you would say if you were like a mafia boss and you were like taking what you want, like lambano. That's all I always remember. But that word means to take. You take what you want. So in any event, that word is basically the inverse of the word to give. In other words, instead of being given over, the husband is taking her. It's another form of the ekdosis marriage. So Heraclides takes Demetria as the genuine wife from her father, Leptines, so there's a transfer of power there, and her mother, Philotas, a freeborn man and a freeborn woman, bringing with her clothing and ornamentation worth 1,000 drachmas. So here, another example of an ekdosis clause going all the way back 400 years before. Power over the wife is transferred from one party to another, and then the dowry is discussed. That's how marriage took place. That's how this marriage takes place. Now, if we stop the shear right here, we would have to, what would we conclude? In other words, we just... Actually, let me put the question a little bit differently. If we deleted the last few sources we discussed, and we only started with this ksuba, what would our conclusion be about how Jewish society looks during this period? Could we even talk about Jewish society?
Looks like everybody else.
Yeah, their assimilation. So much so that one of the early scholars who actually discussed this text actually thought that, well, maybe this was her civil marriage, but she had a real ksuba back at home. As if this was like 20th century America. Obviously, there's no evidence for that. That's... I think certainly incorrect, but sounds like there is not even this isn't not only is this not not only is this sort of another form of Jewish law. It doesn't sound like Jewish at all. In other words, these sound like assimilated people.
But it has the clauses in it that the Mishnah requires.
Which clauses?
About the money, about. You know, I don't know what those five clauses that you said have to be in every.
Yeah, so let's take a look.
You give me those five, but it sounds like she comes with a dowry, he's promising her money.
Right.
We don't have the part about the redeeming her if she's taken captive, but we don't have the whole ketubah here. So, you know.
Excellent.
Was there a standard text, Dina de Malchus or whatever they brought in? They brought Jewish law and Greek culture together. And they made us,
right.
Symbiosis, and it all worked out for everybody's sake.
So let's run with that a little bit. In other words, is there anything in this document that we can identify as potentially either Jewish or at least non-Greek?
No.
So Dr. Schwartzbaum suggests that there's a sum of money here that might be remarkable.
The 200. Only
he said that. Ah, so now, 200 is interesting. Because 200 is certainly, in other words, 200 zuz that she brings in from the dowry is, as we'll see in a moment, certainly what we would expect. But another ksuba that we have from a woman named also Shalom Tzion, but a different Shalom Tzion, she doesn't bring in 200 zuzim, she brings in 96 zuzim. So not enough to qualify for a good ksuba. So in other words, it may be that the 200 is incidental, but there is something else that's remarkable and completely anomalous. In other words, it only is found in Jewish marriages from this period, and that is another another thing that we've seen. Yes, so, what we would call we'll discuss it in a moment. But the idea that the man contributes to the dowry as well, it eventually develops in Egyptian law, but not for another 400 years.
Yeah, but yeah,
and we'll move on from that in a second.
The only question
that I
have is, yeah. Flipping on its head, I mean, isn't there a whole problem if the woman actually gets something?
Well, right. In other words, that's true. But she's not. In other words, even in our ksubos, the woman is not giving anything to the man as part of the transaction of the marriage. She's just bringing in property as a dowry. Or someone is giving property on her behalf into the dowry as bringing property into the marriage. It doesn't represent the transaction that's going on. But you're right. But in other words, that should get us back to the question of, well, even if all of this is true, and we'll see, we're gonna look at some sources in a moment. But even if all of this is true, how do we explain the father giving away his daughter? That doesn't seem to be how Jewish marriage works at all. So take a look at the source from Dvarim that I've given you below here. There are two, basically, ground zero for Jewish marriage, as we mentioned already, is from the is from earlier on in that perek. Ki yikach ish isha uvala usnea. It's talking about the case of what in halacha comes to be called motzi shemra. The details are not important, but basically, the assumption of how marriage works in this part of Devarim is that when a man takes a woman as a wife, and then something else develops, and then the case develops after that. But the assumption that Chazal work with is that that is how marriage is supposed to work. Marriage is supposed to work by a man taking a woman. Now, interestingly, a couple of lines later, in that very same perek, the father says the following about this case. Amar, Avi ha-na'ara, El ha-zakenim, the father of the young woman, says to the elders, in other words, his daughter in the case in Devarim has been accused of being unfaithful. So he says, "Es biti nasati leisha zeh leisha vayisna'eha." I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he hates her. Now, Chazal have a very specific reading of what this refers to, and we're going to come back to that in a moment. But we have spoken several times in the context of this class of something that we've referred to as either common Judaism or complex common Judaism, which is to say that even though there's an incredible variety of Jewish literature, Jewish thought, Jewish practice, and so forth, there is some other words, some people are reading the Dead Sea Scrolls, some people Jubilees, some people this, some people that, some people believe that there's currently a Messiah walking around, some people don't. But there are common threads that we've assumed that unite the Jewish people. And in the past, we've characterized them as, broadly speaking, what would have united all Jews during this period?
Not wanting to be subjugated.
True. In other words, perhaps an attitude, but lots of people don't want to be subjugated. So in other words, that might be too general to describe. In other words, if we had to pick something?
A belief in one God.
A belief in one God. Well, where does that belief in one God come from?
From
Avraham. How do we know about Avraham? How do we know the story of Avraham?
The Torah,
Scripture, the Bible. So in other words, you can read your Dead Sea Scrolls, you can read your Josephus, you can do this and that, but everybody has some sort of baseline text from which they're bound. I think this is actually a very fair characterization of Jewish society during this period. Everybody's reading the Torah, and everyone has to deal with it. So it's feasible that someone read this portion, and instead of understanding the description of how marriage works to be ki kach ish isha, perhaps they understood it as espiti nasati leisha zeh leisha. Maybe that's how marriage should work. The father gives the daughter over. It's one possibility. I don't think it's convincing in this case, because this is actually, it just looks exactly like a Greek marriage. But it's conceivable, and we should keep our minds open to the idea that people are just reading the Torah during this period, and they have to figure out what it means. Now, this would imply something about who is in charge during this period. It might not be that rabbis are in charge. It might be that no one's in charge. It might be that people are trying to figure things out from their own, which would actually give us a picture. It would begin to force us to think about what Chazal's role is. What should we imagine Chazal's role as during this period? We'll shelve that for a second. It happens to be Chazal understand SBT Nosati L'Isha Zeh as a reference to something very specific, and that is Kiddushei Ketana, right? A woman, if a girl is a minor, her father has the ability to betroth her. He loses that ability when she grows up, but at least once he can do this. He can't do it more than once. But he has the right to betroth her. Now, it happens to have been very common, books have been written about this, marriage to minors was exceedingly common during this period. We know of some cases from these papyri where it certainly was the case. This might be one of those cases. In other words, if this was one of those cases, then the father giving away the daughter wouldn't be so unexpected in a marriage document. So that's another possibility. The problem is, we don't have any evidence that that's the case, but we should keep that in mind as well. There is an interpretatio hebraica to this this document. Now, what I'd like to focus on is take a look at the Mishnah next to this. The Mishnah says, Paskal ha-hachnis lo elef dinar, v'hu posek kenegdan chamisha asar maneh, kenegar ha-shum hu posek pachos chamish. If the woman stipulates that she's going to bring into the marriage 1,000 dinar, he stipulates correspondingly 1,500 dinar. Corresponding to the assessment of goods, he stipulates less a fifth. So let's focus on the first part of it. There are actually, I think, two ways to read this. Traditionally, But how do we understand the idea that about what the Mishnah is saying? The Mishnah is talking about a woman bringing money into a marriage and the husband matching it.
Plus 50%.
So that's the one way to understand it, is that's plus 50%. Now, when you say plus 50%, what do you mean? In other words, how much money is there going to be altogether?
It's going to be 2.5 times total what she brings.
So in other words, if she brings in 1,000, he's going to bring in how much? 1,500. And altogether, it's going to be 2,500. Traditionally, that's not how this Mishnah has been interpreted. But if you look at this document, that's exactly the amount of money that's being, or at least the ratio that's being stipulated here. She brings in 200, and he brings in 50, and then he brings in that amount plus another 50.
The last two votes was 200 and 300.
Exactly. Right. So exactly 200 and 300. Exactly what this Mishnah sounds like it might be talking about. Now, the Mishnah doesn't have to mean that, but at the very least. Now it's usually been interpreted to mean that she brings in 1,000 and he brings in 500, and altogether it's 1,500. That's traditionally how it's been interpreted, but it doesn't need to mean that. In other words, la halacha will mean that, but in terms of how history worked, it doesn't need to mean that. Now, regardless of what the Mishnah means, there is one thing, and we've alluded to it already, but there is one thing here that the Mishnah certainly envisioned, and it's unique to Jewish marriage in this period. Both are contributing. The husband contributes, rather the wife contributes, and the husband contributes. Why is this important? The answer is, because although, as we called it, an ectosis marriage, this marriage of transferring the wife from one person to another, is how marriages are taking effect in this period and going back a couple of hundred years, what ends up developing by this time, and it had been so already for 100 years, except for one or two exceptions, one of them we have over here in Oxyrhynchus, is that all ectosis marriages, even though originally the way it worked was you have the ectosis clause, the transferring clause, connected right to the dowry, eventually the mention of the dowry slipped out. Why? Because it was assumed that if you were performing an ectosis marriage, we can assume that the dowry was there. As long as you've used some form of the Greek verb ekdidome, we can assume as a matter of course that the dowry was given kahalacha. That's how the Greeks assumed. In every single Greek marriage document that uses an ekdosis clause, and there are several, the dowry is always recorded. Always. This is very anomalous. It cries out darshani. Why would this occur? I think the answer might be, well, let's speculate. Why might this be the case? Why would the Jewish forms of the ekdosis marriage record the dowry? Based on what we've seen so far, it's a good riddle. The Mishnah tells us that she contributes and he contributes. Now, is it normal for, in the Greek world, is it normal for him to contribute? No. Now, we've said that the Greeks assumed if they saw an ekdosis clause, then there was a dowry there. They just assumed it. Why would the Jews not be able to work with that assumption? Because their dowry looked totally different. In the regular dowry, in the Greek world, the women contributed, and that was that. And everybody could assume, because these were documents that needed to be enforced in a court of law, it could be assumed that if there was an ekdosis clause, she contributed the dowry. The Jews were working with a different form of dowry that's not deriving from Greek law, from Ptolemaic law. It seems to derive from something internal. Maybe it was broadly Semitic, but it's something internal. The Jews are using a different, unique form of dowry where the man contributes also. So no one could assume that just because you had this Greek clause that there was also a Greek dowry. There wasn't. There was actually some other form of dowry. So that's another point. The Mishnah here says that if you're bringing money, then it's plus 50%. But if you're bringing stuff, it's not plus 50%. It's plus 20%. So here she's bringing stuff. You would expect if she was following the Mishnah, it would be plus 20%. That's not the case, but yes.
We created a faith in the David a typology here.
Yeah.
We're using a source that appeared later to try to discern what was occurring.
Excellent. Which source appears later?
The Mishnah.
The Mishnah. Excellent.
All these documents are.
Excellent. Right. So that brings me to the point that I want to make here. First, we're going to make a historical point, then we're going to make a sociological point that applies to us. Number one, if we want to model, as historians, what is going on in this period of Jewish law, and we want to figure out how to fit the Mishnah, how to fit rabbis into it. So I think the best model that we have based on our data is the following. We have, now let's remind ourselves what we have to account for. We have a ksuba, Babatos ksuba, that looks like it was taken right out of the Mishnah. It includes clauses that the Mishnah mentions, the redeeming her if she's a captive, taking her back as a wife, paying her ksuba, letting her stay on if she becomes a widow, having the heirs pay her off. But it also contains something that we wouldn't expect if we just read the Mishnah, which is that she signs the document. On top of that, we have a ksuba written in Greek that doesn't seem to have any of the clauses, at least at first read, doesn't seem to have any of the clauses that the Mishnah would prescribe, and it has a form of marriage that would seem to be either invalid or at least highly irregular according to Jewish law, and yet there is something in that ksuba, namely the fact that the man contributes and the amount that he contributes, that actually does call our ears to the wording of the Mishnah. And that is so strange that the Jews had to write their ksubos, their Greek ksubos, in a way that would have been strange in the context of the wider Greek world. They had to add in something that wasn't being added in everywhere else. What do we do with this data? So I think the answer is that if we have to imagine where Chazal fit into our world, and we're going to, in the next couple of classes, we're going to elaborate exactly how this works and how Chazal see themselves as fitting in. I think the answer is that there is actually a huge Jewish community. We've really been building up to this conclusion now for 2 years. There's a broad Jewish community with wildly diverse practices that all have a common core, and it's all rooted in Scripture, in the Torah. And the Torah needs to be interpreted, but the difficulty of interpreting the Torah, and on top of that, the fact that inevitably over the course of thousands of years, customs, oral customs, traditional customs that don't seem to be derived from Scripture are going to arise. So there's going to be this whole mess of practice, and there's going to be this really lack of unity, lack of uniformity. It's very, I think, damaging to the identity of the people. What Chazal do, this is really the project of Chazal, is they try to systematize everything. Now, they're not the only people who are doing that. We've seen in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, when we've examined them, we've seen in some other sources, that there are all sorts of people across Jewish life during this period who are writing things that say, we know exactly how things are supposed to work. You read the Torah like this, and that's the law for everybody. So they're not the only ones doing this. What Chazal are doing, I think, though, that is unique, is that they're actually, and when we examined the Pharisees, we saw that Josephus says exactly this about the Pharisees. One of the things that Chazal do is they take full account of popular practices. We mentioned it before, there's regional practice, and that's reflected in the Mishnah. In Dead Sea Scrolls, you would never find, in Judea they do this, in the Galil they do this, in Yerushalayim they do this. In the Mishnah, there's a full account of all the things that Jews are doing, and then an attempt to systematize things. So Chazal are really trying to work towards a communal consensus. They're saying, look, we have a community that has lots of different practices. There needs to be some sort of, they needs to be brought to some sort of unity, and there needs to be some sort of leadership, some sort of control. We are going to exercise that control based on our understandings of how to interpret the Torah, but we're going to do that in a way that allows us to build consensus by taking account of the fact that there are these popular practices, that there are these things that people are already doing, and we need to make our peace with that reality. So there's this tension, on the one hand, between an understanding of a need for control and for leadership and for a system to emerge, and on the other hand, for the broad and permanent, really, diversity of Jewish practice. In other words, Jews are always going to be doing lots of different things, and Chazal, I think, come to a much more mature, fully formed understanding of that reality. And it's the reason why I think Chazal are successful as leaders of the Jewish people, whereas others fall by the wayside and are lost to history. The question that we have to ask ourselves now is if this is our view of Chazal moving forward. In other words, they're a group. They're sort of an elite group. They have a keen awareness of the diversity of the people around them, and they're trying incrementally to assert some sort of order over this period, and eventually they're successful. So the question, first of all, that we're going to have to ask ourselves moving forward is, how fast do they do this? In other words, how fast is some semblance of order brought to a broader Jewish community? How do Chazal, sort of accelerate this process? In other words, what strategies are Chazal using to form the ideal that they envision for how Jewish communal life should look? How do they instantiate that ideal? How do they make their dreams a reality? And while this process is going on, how do Chazal see themselves? In other words, do Chazal see themselves as the rulers and everybody else as the subjects? Or is there some sort of, or do they see themselves as totally irrelevant? Or is there something else? In other words, is there some sort of other perception that Chazal have of themselves? But I think the way that we should conclude our analysis this evening is by recognizing that this model of leadership that Chazal exhibit is absolutely crucial for us to internalize as we seek to move forward as a community over the course of the coming years. We as a community, I think, are facing a host of very difficult issues that are going to need to be adjudicated over the next couple of years, whether it be the role of converts in halacha or in our community just sociologically, whether it be women in halacha, whether it be how communities interact in a globalized world. What does minhag ha'makom mean now that we have the internet, now that we have really a globalized Jewish community? All of these things are going to need to be worked out. I think one of the lessons we can learn from our study of this period, sort of from the rise of Chazal and from the eventual leadership that Chazal assert over the Jewish people, and really actualizing the process that the Torah and that Hashem envisions from the start, is by recognizing two things. Number one, that there is, and not only that there is, but there must be, it's a good thing for there to be, a system of halacha, an internal closed system of halacha that operates independently of other influences, and at the same time, a recognition that this system of halacha is not irrelevant, but it won't be impactful at all. It won't be effective at all if there's no concomitant recognition that communal consensus and communal practice must be a factor in how we move forward as a community. When popular practice is a certain way, Psak needs to take account of it. When people require certain things, so they can't just get exactly what they want all the time, that's not how halacha works. There is still this closed system that serves as a check and a balance, but I think this is a system of checks and balances. There is a closed system of halacha that functions independently and ultimately has the final say, but there's also the role of the community, and the community, I think, needs to be taken account of. And the rabbinic leadership that I hope that we should expect, and I think that we as a community deserve over the course of the next few years, next few decades, and Meher Rabbi Yameinu Ad Yemos HaMashiach, and the sort of leadership that I think we daven for when we say Hashiva Shofteinu Kevarishona, is this sort of rabbinic leadership that sees on the one hand the broad and beautiful diversity and respects the beautiful diversity of communal minhag and communal practice and communal needs, while at the same time maintaining ultimate loyalty and fealty to the halachic system. That I bid you all a good night. If there are any final questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Thank you.